Crema.
Welcome to the first episode of The Definitives, a limited-time music podcast detailing the makings and legacies of some of the greatest rock albums ever made. I'm your host, Blake Peterson, and today we'll be talking about Dusty in Memphis, the fifth studio album by the singer Dusty Springfield. When I think about Dusty Springfield, I tend to also think about Rita Hayworth. The names might not immediately ring bells or even make sense alongside one another if you do know who they are. Hayworth hasn't been Jennifer Lawrence-level famous for about six decades. Springfield was ubiquitous, though mostly in the UK, for most of the 60s, and weirdly, for a small portion of the 1980s. What you do need to know about Hayworth is that she was one of the most popular dancers and actresses of her day, and is considered one of the great movie stars. And what you need to know about Springfield is that she was an English, blue-eyed soul singer with beehive hair and a once-in-a-lifetime mezzo-soprano. Today, she's often referred to as an antecedent to modern chanteuses like Adele or Amy Winehouse. From these brief descriptions, I'm sure you're wondering what exactly makes me so tempted to pit the two against each other, and I suppose my reply to that's pretty general and maybe even a bit one-dimensional. What connects them in my mind is this idea of an artist being tethered to a work of art. In 1946, Hayworth starred in this really distinctive, but also kind of misogynist and dated, melodrama called Gilda. In Gilda, she plays a glamorous femme fatale, prone to showing up in bodycon clothing and lip-syncing to sizzling torch songs, just to add to the atmosphere. In 1968, Springfield released the career-defining single Son of a Preacher Man, which was part of the acclaimed soul, or rock and roll, depending on your outlook, album, Dusty in Memphis. Although that LP wasn't commercially successful when it was released, it has come to be considered one of the greatest albums ever made, and is Springfield's touchstone. It's obviously been decades since Gilda, Son of a Preacher Man, and the accompanying Dusty in Memphis came out, and Hayworth and Springfield both died relatively young, therefore becoming frozen in time in a way. But during their pretty short and pretty unhappy lives, they still nonetheless saw what iconhood looked like. For most of their careers, they were able to reap the benefits of decently titanic legacies, more or less defined by one or two works of art. Most of Hayworth's movies have been forgotten, yet she's most often associated with Gilda. Even people who have never seen the movie or don't even know who Hayworth is have likely seen photos of her from the movie in a form-fitting black dress, which I'll attach here. Or maybe they've seen her in the This Is It version of Michael Jackson's Smooth Criminal music video, which starts with the sequence from the most unforgettable scene in Gilda. The movie had an impact on Hayworth's personal life, too. She often intimated that her failed string of relationships had something to do with the fact that men expected her to be the character. This couldn't be further from her personality, which she herself described as shy and, quote, inferior, unquote. In contrast to Hayworth, modern audiences are likelier to know what Springfield sounds like rather than what she looks like. The leading single off Dusty in Memphis, Son of a Preacher Man, is prominently featured on the soundtrack of Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction. If you recall, the song plays in the background during the scene where John Travolta's Vincent Vega meets Uma Thurman's Mia Wallace for the first time. I know that was the first time I heard the song. It was Tarantino who, indirectly, persuaded me to look for more, or I suppose, listen for more. Here's a clip from that scene to jog your memory.
Vincent. Vincent. I'm on the intercom.
Where is the intercom?
It's on the wall by the two African fellows. To your right. Warm. Warmer. Disco.
Hello?
Push the button if you want to talk.
Hayworth and Springfield both respectively reshaped movie stardom and blue-eyed soul singing, yet they've flown under the radar in the years following their deaths. Hayworth has, in a way, become weathered down to a pinup image. And while Son of a Preacher Man might now be an instantaneously recognizable classic, the name Dusty Springfield is not necessarily instantaneously recognizable itself. And if you do know the name and are familiar with Springfield's music, you're probably going to think about Dusty Springfield and its Son of a Preacher Man. You probably can't name another one of her albums from memory. I know I can't. I suppose it's true that Springfield never made an LP quite as good as Dusty Memphis, and that's probably helped stoke this idea of underappreciation. She didn't exactly have a cohesive body of work to back her, which is always key to longevity and memorability. Akin to other rock singers like CeeLa Black and Linda Ronstadt, a powerful voice that was suited best to ballads can only be musically fresh for so long. But like Lauryn Hill's only album, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, or like Liz Phair's confessional masterpiece, Exile in Guyville, Dusty in Memphis and its leading single are works strong enough to have built a legacy and helped define a particular genre, moment in time, and artist. In the first episode of The Definitives, I'm going to talk about the pre-stages, making of, and aftermath of Dusty in Memphis, an album which set a new precedent. Although most people are now wont to think of Dusty Springfield as a solo artist, it took years for her to actually embark upon a career as one. Since childhood, Springfield was musically inclined. She was born Mary Isabel Catherine Bernadette O'Brien in 1939 to Gerard Anthony O'Brien and Catherine Ann O'Brien. Gerard was a tax advisor who longed to be a concert pianist and who had a hot temper. Catherine was a housewife who struggled with alcoholism. Springfield had a younger brother, Tom, and the family grew up in High Wycombe, a large town in the English county Buckinghamshire. The family relocated to Ealing, a district in West London, in the early 1950s. Springfield's family life was dysfunctional. The O'Briens frequently got into arguments, which would often culminate in food fights, and there was some verbal abuse as well. Springfield's father would regularly insult his daughter's looks. This led her to feelings of inadequacy that would haunt her for the rest of her life. Some things remained happy constants in Springfield's life, though. She went to Catholic school, spent much of her time indulging in athletics, which got her the Dusty nickname, and found solace in music. Growing up, she listened to jazz artists like Cole Porter, Duke Ellington, and others. She and her father would play a game where he'd tap out a rhythm to a song on her hand and she'd try to guess the tune. In her preteen, Springfield's interest in music further developed when she recorded herself singing Irving Berlin's When the Midnight Choo Choo Leaves for Alabama in an Ealing record store. Miraculously, that recording survives. Here's a clip.
When that midnight choo choo leaves for Alabama, I'll be right there. I've got my fare. When I see that hefty two time porter man, I'll grab him by the collar and I'll holler, Alabama, Alabama. That's where you stop your train. Now bring me back again, right back where I remain. I'll be feeling grand. And I will be.
As the years progressed, pursuing a music career became increasingly tangible for Springfield. After finishing high school, she sang in local folk clubs with her brother. Soon after that, she joined the singing group The Lana Sisters, which at that time was already established, and later she co-founded The Springfields. The Springfields, which included Tom and another male singer, actually became a moderate success. In 1961 and 1962, the trio was named the top British vocal group by New Musical Express. They recorded three commercially unsuccessful albums that happened to host a handful of singles that became top five successes in the UK. Here's a sample of one of their biggest hits, Island of Dreams, which peaked at number 5 in 1962. Springfield ultimately left the Springfields in 1963, deciding that now was finally the time to start a solo career. In November of that year, she couldn't have picked a better way to reintroduce herself. She released I Only Want to Be With You, an up-tempo pop song written by Mike Hawker and Ivan Raymond. The single, released by her label Philips Records, was a big success, peaking at number 4 on the UK charts in early 1964. The song has since become a staple, covered numerous times, and becoming one of her trademark tunes. Here's an excerpt from that single. Her 1964 debut album, A Girl Called Dusty, was a respectable commercial success, as were subsequent UK albums Everybody Coming Up Dusty, Where Am I Going, and Dusty Definitely, respectively released in 1965, 1967, and 1968. America-specific compilations followed accordingly, What I mean by that is that at the time, it was common for English artists, like the Rolling Stones for instance, to slightly repurpose their British LPs for an American audience. So instead of A Girl Called Dusty being released in America, a slightly altered version called Stay A While / I Only Want to Be With You was. But that didn't necessarily matter. Springfield was better known, like many pop singers are, as a singles artist. She was defined by songs, not albums. And that worked for her. Almost everything she released charted and received a good amount of airplay. By the time 1968 came around, though, Springfield, who had proven herself capable of sliding between soul and rock, began worrying about maintaining the momentum she had been building. While she had a huge international hit in 1966's You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, in 1967, none of her singles charted. And though she had hosted two seasons of a television show called Dusty, in which she sang and traded barbs with rising or established artists in the variety format, she wasn't necessarily breaking any new ground. Continued support from collaborators seemed flimsier now, too. The now legendary singer-songwriter Carole King, whom Springfield often worked with, decided to embark upon a solo career. The songwriting duo Burt Bacharach and Hal David, who also provided Springfield with a lot of material, were going through personal problems of their own. The shifting musical tastes of the public, which now welcomed in heavier rock and roll and underground psychedelia, increased strain. To add insult to injury, her performing career in the UK was unsatisfying. Despite being a household name, Springfield was still mostly confined to low-key tours that often put her in clubs and cabaret-style shows. She was determined to revitalize her career, and she felt this could be done by attempting to make an aesthetically cohesive soul album that paralleled the works of her idol, Aretha Franklin. As the album's eventual leading producer, the Franklin collaborator Jerry Wexler, told Warren Zanes for his book 33 and 1/3, Dusty in Memphis by Dusty Springfield, Springfield contacted Wexler over the phone in New York. At the time, he, affiliated with Atlantic Records, was a huge fan of her work, so when she inquired about possibly making a record with him and the label, Wexler was enthusiastic, and Springfield was signed immediately. For Springfield, this was huge. She had always been inspired by the music put out by Atlantic, and now she would be able to experience the recording process for herself. In her contract, there was a clause commonly known as the Keyman Clause, which means that the contract depended on Wexler's involvement as a producer. If Wexler did not want to subsequently make albums with Springfield, she'd be able to leave Atlantic without any repercussions. Before things really started falling into place, Springfield had often told her manager, Vicki Wickham, that she wanted to make a definitive and authentic soul album. Unbeknownst to her, she was about to make one. Going into the production of what would become Dusty in Memphis, Springfield was nervous. The recording process in America contrasted greatly with the way of producing soul music in the UK. According to Springfield, she had, throughout her career, grown accustomed to walking into the studio and finding everything done beforehand. All the arrangements would be worked out, and so any kind of improvisation was mostly done by Springfield only. And though she did not receive credit, Springfield co-produced most of her albums too. She worked hands-on with recording engineers while they were doing the final mixes, and she regularly fine-tuned various elements of the backing instrumentals. In Memphis, though, things would be different. She would be working with a live rhythm section, and Wexler would be developing the sound as they went. Springfield was made further anxious in part due to the knowledge that so many great singers had recorded in this same space before her, making her feel inferior. She worried that the release of the album would come with negative comparisons. Wexler has, on many an occasion, indicated that uneasiness showed. Combined with Springfield's perfectionist tendencies, it made pre-production and the actual production sometimes difficult. Said Wexler, quote, "Dusty did not present herself as a songwriter at all, so it behooved us to find the songs for her. I had assistants who helped me, who scoured the boondocks for proper material, the B-side of an old Motown record, some old R&B classic. So at our first meeting, I prepared a plethora of material of demos to show her. There must have been more than 50 or 60. Anyway, I played them for her one after another, and she turned them all down." Wexler said that a group of musicians associated with the famed Muscle Shoals rhythm section were waiting outside, thinking that they would do a recording session later. But they had to cancel. Springfield went back to England shortly afterward. Wickham later said that Springfield had a strong gut reaction and was always attentive toward her vocal range, sometimes even more so than the quality of the song. Springfield has since denied that she initially rejected everything Wexler first offered, claiming that while she did reject a large number of prototypes, she did take a liking to Just a Little Lovin' and Son of a Preacher Man, which would come to be included on the album. Springfield eventually returned to the US. Wexler now had a new set of demos. He had about 20, and Springfield apparently liked 15 of them, though immoderately at best. Wexler said the tracks ultimately selected made for one of the finest groupings of material that he had put together up until that point. The collection of songs that would be used for the album built on the more relaxed textures that previous songs like The Look of Love and Spooky had introduced. Here's part of The Look of Love, which hinted at the direction Springfield was moving toward.
Of love is in your eyes, the look your heart can't disguise. The look of love is saying so much more than just words can ever say.
Wickham believes that what made Springfield more responsive to this selection of songs had to do with Wexler smartly deciding to also share which musicians had written them. Because of this, Springfield was more willing to really listen to what was being offered. And if you look closely, the Murderers Row of Talents featured writers Springfield had either worked with before or had admired in the past. The acclaimed songwriting husband and wife team, Barry Mann and Cynthia Well, contributed Just a Little Lovin', which would become the opening track. Jerry Goffin and Carole King offered the bittersweet ballads So Much Love, Don't Forget About Me, No Easy Way Down, and I Can't Make It Alone, which would feature some of Springfield's most expressive singing. A young Randy Newman's I Don't Want to Hear It Anymore, which had been first introduced in 1964, was used to great effect, as was a cover of The Windmills of Your Mind, which had become famous in 1968 due to its prominent usage in the popular movie The Thomas Crown Affair. The inclusion of this song was purposeful on Wexler's part, who thought that he could capitalize on the song's built-in popularity. That popularity, of course, had been boosted when the song won an Academy Award. Because I think Springfield's version of The Windmills of Your Mind is superior to the version popularized by Noel Harrison, I'll play a bit for you here. Recording for what would soon be known as Dusty in Memphis began in the fall of 1968. Sessions took place in the American Sound Studio, which was one of two Southern recording locations Atlantic favored. Today, the American Sound Studio is known for hosting artists like Elvis Presley, Neil Diamond, Bobby Womack, and of course, Springfield's idol, Aretha Franklin. Wexler, Tom Dowd, and Arif Martin were in charge of production. Guitar work was handled by musicians Reggie Young and Tommy Cogbill. And the Sweet Inspirations, a girl group which featured Whitney Houston's mother, Sissy, worked as backing vocalists. In the days before Springfield would physically come into the studio, Wexler regularly had the musicians meet in the recording room around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. For the first few days of preparation, set-in-stone arrangements would not be in front of the musicians, but rather chord sequences. Wexler said that this was a Southern way of recording he had learned at Muscle Shoals. If you wanted to perfect a song, he believed, it was important that the musicians get used to the chord progression so that people would be comfortable riffing and making subtle changes in the future. After the rhythm section would be established, then you would bring in the singer. The issue was, when Springfield was brought in, she wouldn't sing. Wickham said Springfield was overwhelmed and found herself too insecure to really open up in front of this particular group. She ended up finishing her vocal work in New York. Which brings up the truth that Dusty in Memphis wasn't exactly a fitting name for the album. While the rock and roll style instrumental work was done in Memphis, New York is where most of the action happened. Purportedly, that was where vocal work was done, and that was where the strings, which you now hear on the album, were added. There are different accounts of what exactly went on in New York, though. Although it is undisputed that Springfield finished the vocals for the album there, it is controversial whether she did actually ever sing in Memphis. Wexler has always said that she didn't. Arif Martin, by contrast, said that she did sing, albeit rarely. Usually, he said, she would do so only to give the instrumentalist a taste of what she planned on doing later so that they could build on their parts fittingly. Springfield's stage fright, as mentioned earlier, had to do with her fear of comparison. She knew that other artists, like Franklin, were usually comfortable, quote, throwing it down spontaneously or being engaged in the process of continuously modifying vocals based on what the studio musicians were doing. Her nerves prevented her from this sort of collaboration. I've always thought this was odd. Many of Springfield's live performances, for example, contain improvisation and riffing. Springfield did feel more comfortable singing in New York, though. There, the finishing touches would be implemented with Wexler, Dowd, and Martin in Atlantic Studios. Once production continued, she was relieved to find that even without the backing band from Memphis, what Wexler had in mind would remain intact. She was disappointed to find that she wouldn't have as much say in the final mixing as she had in the years before. Her control was severely limited. Her producers decided how her voice would be recorded, not her, and she didn't really know how it would eventually be integrated into the pre-recorded instrumental tracks. In the biography Dusty, Queen of the Postmods, it is suggested that she wasn't given the opportunity to hear the completed versions of the strings and horn parts during her time in New York. Furthermore, supplementary instrumental add-ons were put in without her knowledge. Because the completed record was stitched together across states and involved such a tangle of musicians and producers, it has been suggested that what we now hear is not necessarily what Springfield had had in mind during the stages of pre-production. Supposedly, Dowd, who was in charge of most of the recording and sound engineering, worked in his personal fondness for melodramatic strings and instrumentals. He didn't really keep in touch with the tighter, more exuberantly soulful style Springfield was initially looking for. That being said, what Dowd did ultimately with Dusty in Memphis was impressive. Using 4-track recordings from multiple sources, he was somehow able to make it sound as though everything had been recorded in one room. Different flourishes dipped in and out of the atmosphere effortlessly. And by putting Springfield's voice so much at the forefront of the finished product, what we hear feels far more intimate and vulnerable. Arguably, though, the rhythm section is difficult to hear clearly in a lot of songs, and I sometimes wonder what Dusty in Memphis might sound like without the dramatic strings, instead emphasizing the rhythm section at American Sound Studios. Thinking about how disconnected so much of the making of Dusty in Memphis was, it's always amazed me that production wasn't that contentious. There were moments, though. Famously, there was an incident in New York when Springfield grew so frustrated with Wexler that she threw an ashtray in his face in the control room. She then got mad at co-producer Tom Dowd and called him a prima donna, which led a flabbergasted Wexler to point out that she was the one being a prima donna. Yet according to Wexler, there was never a pervasively negative atmosphere during sessions. There were, as there often are when working on ambitious projects like this one, forgivable intermittent blowups. The production, despite Springfield's fickleness, went relatively smoothly. Recording finished at the tail end of 1968, and the album was previewed by the single Son of a Preacher Man, a song originally intended for, what do you know, Aretha Franklin, who also later famously turned down Let It Be, so it's hard to totally trust her judgment in a lot of cases. The single respectively reached number 9 and 10 on the UK and US charts. That single would be Springfield's last top 10 hit until What Have I Done to Deserve This, a dated collaboration with the Pet Shop Boys released in 1987. I'm sure you recognize Son of a Preacher Man if you hear it, but I'll play a sample for you here anyway. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Yes, he was. Being good isn't always easy, no matter how hard I try. In spite of the single's early suggestion that Dusty in Memphis might become a success, the album's March 1969 release turned out to be an immediately disappointing one. It sold, ultimately, only 100,000 copies in the UK. It topped out at number 99 on the US's pop album chart. According to Vicky Wickham, the dismal sales hurt Springfield greatly. Feeling misunderstood, she understandably wondered if she had made a mistake in taking a risk and recording in Memphis. Critics, however, raved, though most of the talk that Dusty in Memphis is a milestone work is found in more retrospective reviews of the album. In a 1973 column for Newsday, the self-proclaimed American Dean of Rock Critics, Robert Christgau, extolled Springfield. First, he argued against those who undermined her capabilities by condescendingly calling her a girl singer. Then he commended Dusty in Memphis as a whole. Wrote Christgau, quote, When Brian Potter calls it the best album by a girl singer in the past 10 years, he's not just being polite to the opposition. Dusty in Memphis is a pop standard and classic, the kind of record that will sell for years because its admirers need replacement copies, and it is the perfect instance of how a production team should work. Rolling Stone, who talked lukewarmly about the album in 1969, later placed Dusty in Memphis at number 69 on their 500 Greatest Albums of All Time list. In 2012, the magazine said, quote, "The result was blazing soul and sexual honesty that transcended both race and geography." Richie Unterberger of AllMusic recently wrote about Dusty in Memphis in a way that speaks exactly to my admiration of the LP. He said, quote, "Sometimes memories distort or inflate the quality of recordings deemed legendary, but in the case of Dusty in Memphis, the years have only strengthened its reputation. The idea of taking England's reigning female soul queen to the home of the music she had mastered was an inspired one." It can almost be said without bias that Springfield was never able to make an album as exceptional as Dusty in Memphis. She began recording again just weeks after the album's release, again with Wexler, which would result in the 1970 follow-up, A Brand New Me. But that received mixed reviews and fared worse commercially in the US, leading to a departure from Atlantic. This sort of cycle would continue for the rest of Springfield's career. Her albums would either be ambivalently or decently well-received by critics, but failed to make an impression on the public, further reinforcing an unwilling decline in popularity. Post-Dusty in Memphis, Springfield remained admired by the public, but nonetheless struggled with self-harm and drugs and alcohol abuse. These were obstacles that had impacted her for her whole life, but they heightened as she aged. Later in life, Springfield found out that she was bipolar. Much of the tumult in Springfield's personal life partially stemmed from the fact that she was gay. This deepened feelings of self-loathing and inflamed her emotional instability. Springfield's lovers, like Tata Brachi and Norma Tanega, claimed that Springfield's demons made her prone to mood swings that could sometimes escalate into outbursts. There was much tabloid speculation regarding Springfield's sexuality, especially in the 1970s, which at one point became so severe that she went on hiatus and kind of became a recluse in the US. Due to the homophobia of the music industry and the media, she worried about the consequences coming out could have on her career. Thus, she rarely talked about her sexuality directly. She did, however, eventually exchange vows with Brachi, whom she met at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in 1983. Unfortunately, that relationship ended just 2 years later due to the fact that they often got into arguments that sometimes led to physical altercations. All of Springfield's subsequent comeback attempts proved fruitless too. She did, however, enjoy two brief resurgences. One was obviously because of Son of a Preacher Man's use in Pulp Fiction. The other came earlier in 1987 when the Pet Shop Boys asked to collaborate with her on the song What Have I Done to Deserve This, which eventually became a huge hit. Here's a snippet of that song. Springfield would fortunately enjoy renewed success as a result of her work with the Pet Shop Boys. Her 1990 album, Reputation, managed to chart in several countries. But the 90s, unfortunately, were more defined by illness than it would a reinvigorated career. In early 1994, while recording her second-to-last LP, A Very Fine Love, Springfield fell ill and soon found out that she had breast cancer. Although she underwent chemotherapy and radiation treatment and briefly went into remission, she died of the illness in 1999, at the age of 59. Springfield's legacy as one of the greatest performers of all time has endured. If anything, Dusty in Memphis continues to encapsulate what made her such a special talent. In the wake of her death, Springfield's contributions to music, as well as to popular culture in general, have been recognized. In 1999, she was inducted into the US Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and in 2006 was inducted into the UK version. She was also named the 36th best singer of all time by Rolling Stone magazine in the late aughts. Her life and career has been mythologized in stage musical form twice, first with the 2006 Australian musical Dusty, the original pop diva, second with the 2012 jukebox musical Forever Dusty. She also had a profound effect on the LGBT community too. Toward the end of her career, she increasingly came to be recognized as a camp icon in the ways Joan Crawford and Elizabeth Taylor have, her emotional voice and gaudy presentation, oft imitated by drag queens. In 2015, the Equality Forum recognized her as an icon during that year's LGBT History Month. She was also a champion of black artists, particularly those affiliated with the Motown sound. She often covered the works of Motown signees, but she also facilitated opportunities for publicity in the mid-1960s. She set up inaugural appearances on UK television, whether that be on her show or for other shows, for artists like The Supremes and Stevie Wonder. Springfield herself said that she often felt, quote, adopted by Motown and often, quote, hung out with artists affiliated with the label, though she said that she sometimes ran into some resentment based on the fact that she had built so much of her career on soul music and was a white woman. Without Dusty Springfield having popularized female-led blue-eyed soul singing too, we would likely not have artists like Tina Marie, Duffy, Amy Winehouse, or Joss Stone, who were all inspired both by Springfield's sound and sometimes look. Adele, who was often compared to Springfield, was particularly influenced by the singer. Here's a clip of Adele talking about Springfield in a 2009 red carpet interview.
Like, she was like the first British artist to kind of, you know, like female soul singer to break it in America and kind of like putting like English women on the map and stuff, which I love. But Son of a Preacher song, I think the songwriting's amazing in it. I don't even know who wrote that song, but I think it's amazing. And her voice and yeah.
I will say though, Dusty in Memphis is almost certainly a case of style over substance. Because Springfield wrote none of the songs, because everything is largely written from a straight woman's point of view, and because it takes on the aesthetics of a romanticized version of the South, it is largely impersonal. We don't so much take to these songs because of aching confessionality as we might with a singer-songwriter like the frequent Springfield collaborator Carole King or Laura Nyro, for instance. We like it because it captures a mood, a time, and a specific tone, that of a soft, cool sexuality that remains, pardon the cliché, timeless. Especially when you consider the output of rock and soul music at the time, which was so often defined by abrasive, or at the very least, showy, singing. Springfield doesn't overpower her songs, she becomes them, easily and fluidly. My favorite track on Dusty in Memphis continues to be Don't Forget About Me, which is its fifth. Written by the aforementioned King and Jerry Goffin, the song is about a woman who has just separated from her beau. Whatever character Springfield is playing seems understanding that it was time to part ways, but she asks that her former flame remember their time together. There are so many things I love about this song. The most obvious is that it never necessarily mentions a man, which enhances Springfield's performance because we can actually imagine her singing it to one of her ex-lovers. It also flawlessly captures all that the album did well. Springfield gets to show off her lower, breathier register in the verses, only to erupt in the choruses, doing some of the best, most passionate singing of her career. The song additionally sums up how dexterously Dowd made it seem as if all the musicians were in one room. Both the rhythm section of Memphis and the horns and strings of New York are distinctly showcased, but they're never obviously separated from one another. Plus, the song seems to best represent what Springfield was possibly going for when she first pitched the album. Indeed, it does sound like something Aretha Franklin might have released in her heyday. Here's a sample of this song. Springfield was never better than she was in the confines of Dusty in Memphis, and I wonder if deep down her never being able to recreate that same greatness had an effect. But if you could be remembered for a select few things in your life, wouldn't you want to be remembered for something as seamless as Dusty in Memphis? Thanks for listening to the first episode of The Definitives. This episode was narrated, researched, and edited by me, Blake Peterson. If you'd like to know more about me, I recommend heading over to my website, petersoninterviews.com, which focuses on cinema, or my Twitter, at Blake W. Peterson. If you want to follow along with the show, next week I will be discussing the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street. Thanks for listening.